Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd.
Hi, this is Jimmy Corain, and this is another episode of Improv Nerd, and our guest today is Michael McCarthy. Michael has written for Saturday Night Live, Sesame Street, The Drew Carey Show, According to Jim. That's just a couple of his writing credits. He's also one of the most accomplished and respected teachers of comedy writing. He teaches at the I.O. Chicago and at DePaul University. Before we get to the interview with Michael, I want to share something with you that I encourage my students to do in my Artist Low Comedy workshops and classes, and that is to speak to what's going on with them in the moment. So let's say you feel frustrated about an exercise, or you're in your head, or you're pissed off at me. I encourage them to speak that. And actually, the other day I had a student say to me that I was scary, which was kind of cool, because when I was taking classes with Del Close, who was probably the most intimidating, scary guy I'd ever worked with. I mean, this guy was a really big presence. And I had seen in his classes where he had made people cry. And I thought, my God, how cool would it have been, not that I would have been able to do this, to say to Del, you know, you really scared me. I'm really afraid of you. Because that's the stuff for me that blocks me from being the best improviser I can be. Because it takes away. I'm not present. I'm not having a good time if I'm holding on to that stuff. So if you've been listening to this podcast on a regular basis, you know that my wife and I are very close to moving into a new home. And God willing, knock on wood, we will be this weekend moving into our new house. So yesterday was a really stressful day, and people will say to me, aren't you excited? Aren't you excited that you're moving? And I'm like, no, I'm not excited. I am terrified of moving, because maybe I would enjoy it if I didn't think that the whole world is trying to rip me off, the lawyers, the real estate people, the people we're buying the house from. So I'm holding on to all this anxiety and all this fear and all this, people are trying to rip me off. And so yesterday was the closing. And the closing is scary. And if you have never been to a closing basically is where you sign all the documents and you give the money and you buy the house. It's like basically you get your receipt for your purchase. So yesterday was the closing. It was down in the loop in a big office building, which was like right on the river. It was on the Chicago River. And so we drove down there, my wife and I, and I'm a wreck. And driving down there, my wife is just tell me all your fears. And I'm just listing them. The people that were buying the house are ripping us off. They didn't really fix the things they said they would. The lawyers are going to screw us. The real estate people are going to screw us. The window they said they're fixed. It's not going to be fixed. It's going to cost us a couple grand. They didn't fix the screen door. We asked them to fix the screen door. All these fears. So I'm saying all this. We get to the office. Nice office, by the way. They bring us into this conference room. And now there's two lawyers. Our lawyer, who's wearing a tie, and their lawyer, who's wearing a golf shirt. And then our real estate agent, who is wearing a blue suit and a tie. Now, he's worked with us for 2 months. This is the most dressed up I've ever seen. So he waits for the last day that he works with us, and he gets dressed up. And then there's some guy who's sitting in a desk away from the conference table who basically just makes copies for the lawyer and writes checks. So I sit down next to my wife, next to our lawyer, across the table from their lawyer and our real estate agent, and I say, I don't trust anybody in this room. Their lawyer, the guy in the golf shirt, goes, I wouldn't. You know, there's two lawyers in the room. And I'm like, yeah, two lawyers and a real estate agent. All we need is a car dealer. I got to tell you something. Me saying that, I felt so good. First of all, I was proud that I was being honest in the moment. And second of all, it gave me the opportunity to experience the gratitude that what we were doing. We're getting a new house. It also got me to experience the joy more and to let go of that I was holding on to. And how this applies to improv is I admit, I'll call people before and I say, look, I'm scared to do the show, or I'll call someone before I'm teaching a class and I'm going, I have nothing to teach these guys. I don't know what I'm doing. If I can admit that, I can access the joy because improv is joy. That's why we do it. No one's getting rich off of it. We're doing it to have fun. So the lesson I learned yesterday is admit where you're at. You know, I tell my students to do it. Now I need to take the lesson. I think you're really going to enjoy this interview with Michael McCarthy, especially if you're an improviser aspiring to be a comedy writer. Let's say you want to write for one of the late night shows, Kimmel or The Daily Show, or you're interested in sketch, you want to write for SNL, or even if you want to write for a sitcom. Michael McCarthy is the guy. He's got so much experience doing it, but he's also so thoughtful. He's a thoughtful person in terms of teaching this. He's really developed his own method. So we talked a little about his method. We talked about his experience. Michael has a very interesting path. He wrote for Saturday Night Live. He wrote for Sesame Street in New York, and then he decides he wants to come back to Second City and start working in the theater. And Michael rose through the ranks there, and he ended up performing several shows on the main stage. He talks about his philosophy on comedy and his philosophy on comedy writing. I think you're really going to enjoy this.
He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd.
Thank you. It's good to see you.
Good to be here. Thank you, guys. You have nothing better to do on St. Patrick's Day?
I think a lot of people are hungover, except us.
Right.
We're not hungover.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
So
Jesus, Mary, and Joseph.
Yes. You're Irish, right?
I am.
100% Irish?
Kind of. I mean, if you break down Ireland, Dublin is actually a Danish word, and so I'm part Danish and part Irish, so I like to think that I'm 100% Irish. But Ireland is kind of a country of mutts anyway. There's the Normans, and a lot of people, you know, the Black Irish or Spanish, and a lot of empires.
But you were born in Cleveland, Ohio, right?
I was.
But you guys traveled, you lived in different countries a couple.
We did. We moved every 2 years when the rent was due.
Mm-hmm. Were you a poor Irish family?
Well, my folks were teachers. My dad was, I'm the oldest of five.
Uh-huh.
My dad was incredibly thrifty. Like, I wish I had gotten that ability. We lived in Ibadan, Nigeria when I was 5, 6, and 7. And then we came back through Europe on our way back. And we went 6 weeks all over Europe camping. And there was a book in the mid-60s. I think it's still around, but it was called Europe on $5 a Day. And my dad did it with a family of six. I'm not kidding.
What kind of stuff did he do to make that $5 work?
We camped everywhere, and then he would do things like, you know, if we went, you know, well, he would never go to Colonel Sanders, but if we bought a chicken, there were stages of it. You know, there was the chicken, and then there was soup, and then there was croquettes. It was like, I don't know how he did it. It's like some kind of bizarre household Mobius strip of just this chicken just never died. It just kept going and going. And my brother Matthew, when he was really upset at like 15, was screaming at my father going, I'm going to leave home and I'm going to go to Kentucky Fried Chicken and throw out the bones, is what he screamed. I'm going to throw out the bones.
Why did your dad save the bones?
Well, he made soup. He would make soup out of it. So he was depression kid and all of that. And then I think haunts me still is rebelling against that, which is insane.
Well, how did you rebel against it?
By, you know, living beyond my means and racking up huge credit card debt, you know, like America.
Right. How did you get interested in comedy?
My parents were really, they loved Bill Cosby. One of my first is, I think we were living in Cleveland, we'd moved back from Africa, And they bought an album by Bill Cosby called I Started Out as a Child. And I never saw them laugh so hard as that. And so as a kid at second grade, I memorized it. I memorized both sides of it. And I had no idea what it, because he's talking about, you know, the Lone Ranger on radio. I have no, you know, street football. I have no idea what he's talking about mostly. But then they would trot me out to do bits.
You know, well, in front of like
the family.
The family, okay.
You know, and I had a really good Bill Cosby impression that I did, and the black Philadelphia accent. I don't know. I had no idea. It was just a way of getting attention. And then I guess the first, like, well, SNL, well, Monty Python would be the first thing where I kind of went, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, that. I remember reading Phil Berger's The Last Laugh, which was interviewed
with comics,
with all these stand-ups. And then, maybe that was in college, and then seeing, no, Monty Python was before I went to college, but Python to me was like, and this would repeat itself, is kind of, this is my tribe. Ah, I get it. And then when I saw Second City, ah, right. And SNL, I saw Monty Python, then the first episode of Saturday Night Live was October of 1975, and I weirdly saw it, George Carlin hosting. And then I went to Second City. My freshman roommate at Ohio University was a wonderful guy named Mike Pearl, who grew up in Highland Park here. Mm-hmm. And he saw that most of my albums were comedy albums, and he told me about Second City. And so in between my freshman and sophomore year, I came to Chicago and saw
you them. You saw them. Do you remember who you saw?
I way remember. In that cast, the show was called Freud Slipped Here. And it was, I know them all, they're fairly good friends. Danny Breen, Tim Kazurinsky, Bruce Jericho, Mary Gross, Megan Fay, maybe Larry Coven may have been in that cast. And they, you know, it was just amazing. It was amazing because I think it was a Sunday night. The weirdest thing about Second City for me, particularly in that kind of old school style, was because you go and you go, this is amazing. And then you see the improv set, I can't believe they make this up. And then the next night you come back and it's exactly the same scenes. Oh, they're lying to me. You know, and they were in previews to their, you know, so they're preparing a new show.
And so then you come to Second City in 1981 and you intern, right?
Right, I was the first intern.
Right. And then you, as an intern, you get to sit in one of Del Close's classes.
Yes.
And you go in and sit in Del Close's class, and it totally freaks you out. Can you tell us what he was doing in that class that freaked you out?
Yes. He, and I'm 21, okay, so he warmed up the class with a Latin devil chant. So he, you know, where normally you would just be, I don't know, doing some kind of...
You play Zip Zap Zap, moving around in the space?
Right, yeah, enacting some sort of dramatic death, something to get the juices flowing. And so, I forget the words, but I just fucking freaked out. I ran into Joyce Sloan's office.
Who was the producer of Second City then?
Right, she was all of our godmother, and I went, do you know what he's doing in there? And she went, such a bad impression, Michael... Dell's like a film festival. 90% of him's bullshit, but 10%'s really good. And I have to say, in terms of that's the role that Joyce Sloan played in a lot of our lives, because she helped me understand that you can take and leave stuff. And because at that kind of delicate moment she kind of reoriented me, I was able to go back and experience the best teacher I've ever had is Del Close. You know, I think...
What did you get out of him? I mean...
Oh, amazing stuff that, you know, I mean, like my wife Susan will say, you know, sometimes you would get a 3-hour lecture on Iranian TV.
Right.
For no reason. And then, but then suddenly there'd be like just this amazing storm of mind-blowing stuff. Like in the space of 15 minutes, it was not quantifiable. It was this kind of ebb and flow. But I thought of him as kind of the professor of last resort, I would describe him. You know, where all of us were kind of these broken toys, and we, you know, and he would made us all feel first and foremost like artists, and treated us that way. and called us on really cheap shit. Like, and he gets a lot of, like, people criticize Del all the time as being misogynist and homophobic, and I suppose maybe he was, but, or not so homophobic, certainly misogynist. But I think the thing with Del was he did not suffer fools. And so when you had somebody, you know, like a musical theater actress coming down from Northwestern and going, and kind of playing it like that, he would just go, shut the fuck up, you know, and he would go, and it was kind of, he was honest, he was not, and he would never laugh when things weren't funny and all that, and he became, he set the bar really, really high, and when you got a compliment, you could live on that for months, getting a compliment from Del. And of course, I was there before long form. You know, mm-hmm. It was all sort of pre-Herald. Pre-Herald, and yeah, and so we sort of were maybe kind of nipping at the heels of that in some of what we were doing. But it was one of those magical moments in my life where, and this is rare, where you never, you're in the class, you never wanted to be anywhere else. It was just, I'm so glad I'm here, constantly, that. I mean, except for the 3-hour lectures on Iranian TV.
And then from there, with really not much training, right? After you interned at Second City in 81, at 24, you become a writer for Saturday Night Live.
I did.
I mean, you must not have had much, you didn't have much experience at that point.
No, I
how did you get that job?
Well, when I was at Ohio University, which is a really good school for media, And I'm serious. So when I was a sophomore, I went Second City. I became incredibly tunnel visioned on working here, working in Chicago and working at Second City. And so I put together and videotaped sketch shows. I did 3 of them. And I remember taking the videotapes to Second City, and I was showing, I was not being Machiavellian at all, but Tim Kazurinsky happened to see me. I think it was a 3/4-inch tape.
Yeah, they were these big,
gigantic,
tape, yeah, like a now, box of cookies. They were huge.
And now they're, you know, everything
is a chip. Yeah.
This. So I was playing something. I think I was editing something, and he saw a sketch we had done at Ohio U and loved it, and said, "You should submit to SNL." And he had just been hired as an actor, so I did, and that's how I got hired and went away to New York. Way too soon. A lamb among wolves, or, you know.
So, and it's very competitive. It's Saturday Night Live. You're writing for a cast that's got Eddie Murphy, right? Jim Belushi, Kazurinsky, as you mentioned, Julius Louis-Dreyfus, and you're young, right?
I am.
Did you get sketches on?
Oh yeah.
You got sketches on?
Yeah. I am. And Joe Piscopo, my favorite, who Joe is the definition of karma to me. That's
'cause in what way?
Well, the way he treated people and
like shit.
Happened. Oh yeah.
Give me an example of how bad.
Well, I always thought, because I was 24 and very frightened and very young, and I did not work for Lauren. I worked for Dick Ebersole, and Dick was a sports guy. He came up through ABC and Rune Ardledge, and so he handled comedians very poorly, like the 1-minute manager of a lot of, you know, where he's I think Wharton School of Business, and he went to Yale, and there's a lot of that kind of, you know, like if you went into his office to argue, he would open the door, and he had built a platform for his desk, and he had rearranged the lights, and there was a lot of that kind of like, and you know, I'm 24 thinking, well, if I work hard, I'll just and they're, you know, they, it, oh, with getting back to Joe, for instance, treated his wife like a member of his corporation, which I hated. I hated that, like yelling at his wife in the hallway and not treating fans nice at all. And I think he was supremely jealous of Eddie because they had both come up through the clubs together, and Eddie was sort of America's sweetheart. And Joe was kind of, oh, and this insane moment I remember, it was, they had, it was Frank Sinatra, Joe is Frank Sinatra, and Eddie is Stevie Wonder. And we chewed up like half a day of rehearsal because, this is a Joe story, because Frank would never wait for Stevie. You know, that fucked up Jersey, let's treat Frank like the Pope or whatever.
Right.
And so we would.
His character, he's saying as his character, Frank would never do this.
Yeah, Frank would, Frank would never wait.
Right.
So they, and the way it worked was, Joe, because Dick Ebersole and Joe Piscopo couldn't talk to each other, so Joe goes back to his dressing room, calls his manager in California, the manager calls Dick Ebersole's manager in New York, Dick's manager calls Dick's manager calls Dick. Dick says no. So it's, they're like 20 feet from each other, but they have to like talk about this. And you know, as a, I always, you know, my time at SNL was. Did you ever see the movie Bridge on the River Kwai?
No, I didn't.
Did any of you see Bridge on the River Kwai? It's probably my favorite movie. Is at one point at the end where the doctor, they've blown the Brits have blown up the bridge they built, and. And the doctor, who's kind of been sitting in the background the whole movie, is just walking through this burning river going, madness. Madness. That's what I saw. That was the role for me. It was like just the complete introduction to vanity on a level you would need NASA instruments to calculate. You know, it was just so huge, the vanity.
Did you get fired from that job?
Oh, probably.
What do you mean, probably?
Well, no, proudly, I said.
Okay, what do you mean, proudly?
Well, there are some people you would wish to offend.
Probably. Right.
Tim and I both, I was writing partners with Tim. And
Tim Kazurinsky.
Right, and they brought, that the year that I was there for one season, and I was kind of linked with Tim, and it would have cost a lot of money to bring Tim back, so that's why we both left, but... I think that was enough for me, and proudly, within a few months, I was working at Sesame Street, which is really the antidote to SNL, I think. So I was grateful for that.
And how was that writing for Sesame Street? Here you
the best. It was the best.
How do you write for children? Did you approach it that way?
Oh, it was hard. I had to really. Well, for one thing, Jimmy was. I had no idea before I started working at Sesame Street. How much innuendo was a part of my process, you know? Like, just through college and Second City, and a little bit at Second City, and then certainly SNL. And they have no patience for innuendo at Sesame Street. You can't have Big Bird going, hey, check out Maria.
Right. Because you know what? If I was Big Bird would never do that. Yeah, I just want to let you know. Right. Joe Piscopo has played Big Bird. He'd never do that. Yeah, I'd never do that.
Frank wouldn't wait for Steve.
Yeah.
Let's have the engineers.
So you got all this in. You got to. So how did you adapt then?
Oh, I like a Sesame Street. A typical episode of Sesame Street is 8 pieces, 6 street pieces that takes place in front of the 123 building. You know, and then there's a Muppet piece, and then a cast insert where you have a cast member doing something they normally would. Or
I didn't know themselves. It was this down to this much of a formula.
Oh, they do over 100 episodes a year, so it's when you get a printout of curriculum points. So basically, the way I learned was just volume. I wrote lots and lots of stuff, and there was a head writer, Norman Stiles, who was very. Who had worked on Fernwood Tonight, and then, he was very good at sort of going, here's our little corner of the world. Here's why this isn't appropriate. I think this is very funny, it's not right for our show. Oh, this is right. You know, so for me, it was basically throwing a lot of stuff at the wall until eventually 8 pieces stuck, and then I learned to flourish. I really, really enjoyed it.
So then you make a decision to come back to Chicago.
Yes, there was a writer strike and a director strike, and I remember temping, among other places, in the Trade Towers. I learned a software system called Mass 11 during the writer strike, which was a financial software. I'm sure it's way outdated now, but I took a 2-week course, and so I would do this and. I was doing industrials for McDonald's. I was directing these industrials for a company here called Media Relations, and I hooked up with a friend of mine, Jeff Machowski, who was directing the touring company, and he was holding auditions. And he asked me Sunday night if I wanted to audition, and I said yes, I did. And Second City is kind of a cult in the sense that I mean, in classic cult descriptions, you know, like you work all the time, you make no money, you, and I think I was still under the sort of illusion of that, you know, that I had, because I had been an intern, I kind of wanted to go back and complete that. And so I auditioned, I got in, I toured for a year and a half, and then I did two shows in ETC and three on the main stage, and it was a wonderful time.
Now I got to ask this just because I am so fascinated by this, and I actually took the question on. I'm putting it back in. You worked with Carell, Steve Carell.
I did.
Who, and I knew I worked with him a little at the Business Theater, but very little. When you worked with him back then, did you think, oh, this guy's going?
No, and I've talked to people who like worked with Bill Murray, mm-hmm. and they, you never. It's not. It's such a weird thing about, you know, like shooting Skeet, mm-hmm. like who becomes a star and who doesn't. Steve was incredibly nice, incredibly dedicated, like way beyond, like rarely, like with a given Second City ensemble, it depends, you have all sorts of people with all sorts of disciplines. Mm-hmm. Like you have the pure improvisers, and then you have kind of the writer people, and then you have really schooled actors. And Steve was all three, and he worked very, very, very hard, and he was very funny. Like in terms of improv sets, I never saw anybody like pull an ending out of his ass better. He was really great at making other people look good, and we did three shows together, and I remember we were gearing up for the third one, and I said that I was leaving, so. We had never really done a scene together. And so we did three scenes together in the last show. And those were wonderful because we wanted it to be, you know, when you go into previews for a Second City show, there's lots of stuff. What we did was do three scenes expecting one to get in, and all three of them got in. But he was very funny guy. I see him periodically. But he's kind of drifted into French aristocracy. He's kind of like, I think owns a small island.
And then so after that show, you decide you're gonna leave Second City and go to L.A.
I did, yeah.
And I can imagine being on the main stage doing three shows and the two shows at ETC. There's a sense of like, the world is my oyster.
Yeah, it really is a wrong, too. there's a kind of
entitlement.
Yes,
yeah.
Entitlement is a great word for it. It's kind of a, and even if you pretend to not feel it, you feel it. Like even if your kind of MO is strategic self-effacingness, you do kind of go, well, I'm here.
So when you left to go to
my sitcom? Yeah.
When you left, did you want to become a writer or a star?
I suppose, because I'd always had an agent from New York. I was with APA, and I think I wanted to be a writer. And I think what LA did at that time, at least, did not understand is that at Second City we wrote our shows. The credit at Second City when I left was purely an acting credit. They never kind of saw it as a writer credit. So I had to kind of start from scratch again. I had to write two spec scripts. My agent actually died. Richard Krawitz passed away, and his assistant took over, and she didn't include me anymore. So I was like suddenly in LA, you know, writing Mad About You and Home Improvement.
And what is it? You did a great video on YouTube around the 50th a couple years ago about people having the Second City credit on their resume.
Yeah, yeah, that's a pet peeve of those of us.
So tell us why it bothers you so much.
Well, because you know, first off, you know people. I mean, I've been on both sides of the desk.
Explain what it is that pisses you off.
Well, you know, like you take a workshop and you say that
it's Second City.
Yeah, and there's particularly now, my God. There's DEF CON level 12A
right.
mugging.
Right,
you know, like,
yeah.
Where when I started at Second City, there were six people that worked in the office, and one of them was a junkie mm-hmm. named Nick the Broom. you know, now it's the biggest theater school. And so when you, like, so if you're, because I worked on the first year of Mike and Molly, and, you know, you periodically you would see resumes, and you'd go, wait a minute. Wait, I was there in the early 90s. You were, what? No, you took Blair's Workshop. I hate you. You know, it's the idea of just pretending that you didn't suffer. Like you haven't gone through that level of that much focus. You know, it's something for nothing. It's, you know, I suppose if I was saying that I worked at Harvard, you know, I was on the Harvard Lampoon and I wasn't, I would be the same. It's just misrepresenting yourself.
You worked Mike and Molly, and that was a Chuck Lorre show.
Yes.
And
right.
Chuck Lorre, of course, you know, the whole thing with Charlie Sheen and Two and a Half Men. How was, and then you also worked on Drew Carey.
Right.
How were those shows different to work on?
Well, there's similarities in the sense that writing, you know, by committee, like writing a sitcom is, it is what it is, you know, and there's not a lot of room for, you know, it's like, you have to be a showrunner, it's almost like Stalin, and that you have to get the train to the station on time. And
so do you come in and there's 12 people sitting around in a room?
Eight. Well, there's two levels. There would be the producers who would be coming up outlining stories, and then there would be and the other crew, which would be kind of the newer writers who would be coming up with, they would come up with a list of story ideas, and then the producers, executive producers, co-executive producers would be outlining them. And then there would be rewriting together, gang writing, where you would come up with alternative lines, it's called. Or that a team or a single person, you would outline a story and then you'd go off and write it.
Yourself?
Yes, like take a weekend to write a script, you bring it back and then everybody tears it apart and mm-hmm. puts it back together. And the process is by committee. And there are really good things about that and really, really bad things. And I worked in London for 2 years, and you know, the London process is more playwriting than it is sitcom staff. So one or two people write six episodes, say, in the course of a season, and they call it a series. Mm-hmm. And then, and so there's good and bad things about that. The thing about the American thing is you just produce a lot. You do 22, 26, 30 episodes a year, depending upon your deal. But it's sort of like nobody can claim complete ownership or take responsibility for it. You know, like the nice thing about the British way, and I think about playwriting, is you, better or for worse, you are responsible for that play, where, you know, you can obfuscate all sorts of things when you're on a staff, you know, which was sometimes frustrating. And the other thing, too, is about sitcom writing, and I'm completely done with it, because I did it for a long time and don't want to do it anymore, but nobody is happy. Nobody writing sitcoms, nobody, to a man and woman, everybody has that kind of like, fuck me, you know, like that.
Why aren't they happy?
Because they're...
Too much money? Too easy of a work schedule? Too much fame? What is it?
I think it's, those are all good questions. I think that it's the idea of it not going their way. And the success...
What, they don't have control of it?
Right. Susan, my wife, describes it as a low-grade flu. Which is a really good, like all of LA has kind of a low grade flu. And there's a kind of like, I'm not being appreciated. First off, huge narcissism to not be grateful. Because who's worth $10,000 a year? I mean, a week.
That's what
all of you.
Is that what you were making? About $10,000 a week?
No, I wasn't making that much. But, you know, those, when you drift into co executive producer and all of that, that's seven figures.
Okay.
And so there. So
what was the most you were making? $20,000 a week? You had to be.
Depends. I was probably no. I was under 10. I was making probably 7 or 8.
Okay.
When I was, because what happens is you become a term writer, and then you become a story editor, and then you can co-producer, and you matriculate up this almost military system.
You know
and
what?
Then you're also making money from when your episode airs. You're getting residuals. So you're getting like a base salary, and then you're getting...
Because, you know, everybody wants to write for sitcoms, but I don't think people know how much money people really make. How much...
Well, it's less and less now because of several reasons. Karma. Mm-hmm. and also the fact that people are not watching television in droves, you know, so they're, you know, they're finding, and I think it's kind of like that Jeff Goldblum thing about nature finds a way, because particularly when I moved out to LA in 93, 94, they were so nauseatingly cute and so self-referential that they deserve to go away. Like, a lot of times sitcom writers rail about reality TV, how awful it is, but I maintain that it was appropriate. Because they were really this sickeningly sweet and kind of like low budget versions of Neil Simon plays, and I contend, and one of the reasons for coming back to Chicago too is that it is so burned out that we're in this kind of post World War II I Love Lucy mode that, I mean, I'm a middle aged white man and I'm alienated by the stories, like I can't relate to them. Which is a terrible barometer. You know, like, why aren't there sitcoms that take place in trailers with, you know, my stepson Liam in LA came home from school with a note in three different languages, English, Spanish, and Farsi. Why isn't that being represented on TV? You know, there's this huge melting pot that hasn't earned a recognition. And also the other thing that I rail against is that, for the most part, those staffs are entirely composed of Eastern-educated white men, who, even if you're liberal, you're gonna conclude the same things. The only thing to break that up is kind of diversity: more women, more people of color, as opposed to people of pallor.
All right, we're gonna improvise now. Okay. And Emily, let's do like five, because I want to come back and talk about, so we'll do about a 5-minute scene. We'll come back and we'll talk about it, because I've got a lot more to ask you that we haven't even gotten to.
Great, Jim.
Okay, so we're just going to take a location. We're going to go about 5 minutes, and then we'll come back and talk about it. All right? And how are you feeling about this? You told me a little earlier you felt rusty.
Oh, you'll see.
Okay, great. Okay, all we need is a location.
A magic store.
Okay, great. Thanks. Yeah, get one of those too.
Cup and balls?
Yeah, cup and balls. Wait. Do you want to steal it?
Yeah. Cool. If I get caught, I'm a bad magician. If I make it, then I'm a good one.
Okay, great, cool. Okay, we'll keep it in your pocket.
Okay.
Take some.
Stuff?
Yeah.
Okay. You want to participate in this?
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay.
I'm your assistant.
Some cards? Oh, yeah. Grab some cards? Yeah, I hit the rope with three different ends.
Is this cool?
Yeah. I love these old places.
I do too.
Yeah, it's so dusty and no cameras. That's the best thing.
Yeah.
Let's see. How about a good sword box? Do they have a sword box?
Are you sure? I think that might be a camera over there.
Really?
Yeah.
In Ling Chao's Magic Fun Fest? A camera? What is this place come to?
Yeah.
I feel so betrayed.
Well, I think this might be good for our career.
That we get arrested?
Yes. We'll get publicity and people will know about you.
And you.
Really?
Yes.
Me?
Yes, you would be. I can't.
You're kidding!
I can't be number one forever. I can't keep.
Are you saying
that you'll take over?
No.
Yes.
Oh my God, Miguel, thank you.
Oh, you're
thank you.
The duck.
Okay.
We'll get another one.
Yeah.
Yes, you'll take over. It's easy. I mean, I want you to think that it's hard, but it's really easy. It's done with mirrors. I'll show you everything.
You'll do that?
And when I die, you can have all my equipment. You can go on to great heights.
All the video equipment, all that stuff.
I mean, there's a whole world out there waiting for you of rest homes and kids' parties. Unbelievable stuff. I know. I'm kind of showing you behind the man behind the curtain. You heard it.
I don't know if I deserve it.
You do.
You really do. You studied. You went to like a great school for it, and all I did, I've just been an apprentice for a couple of years.
No, I studied under the great Gemstone. and he was a pedophile, and that's how I became a magician. I kind of spared you that other part. But you have it. You have this. You can do this. I know you can.
But, you know, when we did the saw thing, right. Remember you cut me in half?
Right.
I mean, you actually cut my finger off. And that was totally my fault. So I got nervous.
I understand. I would, too.
Every time I'm in front of people, I get nervous, Miguel.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that never really goes away, and it's a good thing. It's a good thing, Jimmy, that you're nervous.
Why is that good?
Well, because
I never see you being nervous up there.
Oh, I'm inside. I'm a jello. I'm a bundle of nerves. I hate them.
Well, but how do you not be nervous up there?
Marijuana. I'll smoke pot, actually.
My dad smoked pot.
I know, I'm sorry. I put off telling you, but you should know. And what happens is when you become more and more famous as a magician, they give you drugs. You become...
I don't know if I'm willing to trade for that lifestyle.
I understand. But think about it. Think about it. Think about, you know, becoming more famous and having your mind lose its elasticity. There's a lot to be said for it. I mean, there's a lot, you know, look at the Grateful Dead. Look at the players and coaches of the Miami Dolphins. The writing staff of Give Me a Break. All of them were podcasts.
I just can't. I don't know, Miguel.
Well. I don't want to push you. What we can do is start. You could create your own way of anesthetizing yourself to the audience's self-loathing.
Like with food, maybe.
Food would be a good one. Gambling, sex addiction. There's a whole.
I don't have to get high.
No. Oh. Man, there's all sorts of ways to numb yourself. Bourbon. S&M. What else?
How does that numb me?
Oh, well, it makes you hurt.
I'll find my own.
I understand. Very
okay.
Kind.
What are you kind in terms of what?
Well, you know, actually creating
a scene.
A scene.
Well, so how did what did you feel lost up there or?
Oh, a little bit. I always talk in my classes, the writing classes I teach, that one of the things wrong with SNL is people standing with no physicality saying snotty things to
right.
each other, and suddenly I realized where the genesis of that criticism comes from.
How did you feel about your performance?
Excellent.
No, really?
I could have had a character. I could have done more object work. You know, who, what, and where. I could have gone to my where more. We were in a magic store.
Right.
Thanks to Mr. Richard Label.
Uh-huh.
Which is something I have some familiarity with because my dad was a magician.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was just the idea of standing and talking is not improvising. And I don't think I made you look that good. I should have.
What would you have done to make me look better?
Oh, I would have said yes more.
Mm-hmm.
Yes and, as they say. You know, I'm... And I also found out more about your character.
Mm-hmm.
Asked a lot of questions. No, I'm not supposed to do that.
From the top, I was like, I do not want to be a guy in a magician shop and a customer. So I'm like, okay, let's go to the relationship.
Right.
And I think we discovered it, you know?
Yeah. And I... A couple of cheap moments.
Well, the thing that I like about your improvising is you're a good enough writer that even when you're lost, you can come up with stuff that's going to get laughs, right?
Hopefully.
Can that be a crutch too?
Way a crutch. In fact, when I first started at Second City, when I was in the touring company, because I was coming from New York and writing,
I was always, I mean, the worst thing you can do to an improviser is say, here, look, I wrote this sketch. Let's do this Monday night. Mm-hmm. And that's and do it the way I wrote it. You know, and so what I had to learn pretty quickly, and I worked with really good people, is to give up the idea. Is you just go, I have this premise, go. Mm-hmm. You know, and you give up ownership and you give up, in a sense, you just kind of give it up to the collective, which in my experience is always better. So once you kind of have that has happened enough, you kind of learn to embrace somebody else's. You celebrate what they bring to it.
Well, that had to help when you were writing in committee on Molly, Mike and Molly and Drew Carey.
It is. It's a tough thing because you get so angry about stupid stuff.
Like?
Well, like your joke not getting in. Or the thing that happens in a writer's room a lot of times is this kind of subterranean communication. Like, I laughed at your thing and you'll laugh at my thing and I know you from this job and... So your stuff is going to get in, and it's constantly changing, and it's and everybody's aware of it. But it does not serve the process to have that kind of hidden agenda at work, and that's probably talking before about why a lot of people are unhappy is that they have a hidden agenda. It's not paying off. Also, the people in charge a lot of times are threatened, which is not a good thing.
Or stupid, I find.
Extremely stupid. You know, I mean, well, it goes back to nobody, like the H.L. Mencken thing about nobody went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American public. And that's really true. Like, we were talking earlier about when I worked at Q101, which is...
A show here on the radio.
We have morning radio, and that's, if you have too much serenity in your life, work in morning radio. That will take care of it very quickly. But the scariest thing we could do is, let's open up the phone lines and just listen to what our listeners, because it's just constantly censoring the, you know, and crazy. And maybe they're, it's a scary thing, the general public, mm-hmm. You know.
I'm scared of them all the time, but I'm scared of a lot of things. We got time. I'd like to have open it up for some questions.
Sure, sure.
So if you've got questions for Michael, great. There we go.
Hey.
Just out of personal curiosity, you mentioned some of your stuff got on at SNL.
Yes.
What were some of the sketches and characters you got on?
Something that you might know from that year. James Brown's Hot Tub. I was part of that, in the room for that. Michael Palin, my favorite scene was probably, a lot of my favorite stuff didn't get on, but I did a thing called, Michael Palin hosted, and I wrote a thing called The All New House of Mutton, where he was a restaurant entrepreneur.
Did it get to dress? A lot of people, like, the process is, some sketches get on. There's a dress rehearsal before, like a couple hours before. Some get cut before the show. Did that happen?
That happened a lot. My year, I think I had, I don't know, 20, 30 pieces on, and then maybe certainly as many got cut and didn't get any attention. Because basically the way the process works is you meet with the host on Monday, and then you have basically Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and everything is due Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. So it's basically you don't go home between Monday and Wednesday. And then the PAs type it up, and then the read-through is about at 1 o'clock. And that's a horrible thing, because the writers have not slept, so they're incredibly tired and vulnerable. And then they're giving it over to these actors who a lot of times don't get it. Which is, that's a great thing, to spend 6 hours on a scene and have somebody whose name will remain nameless.
Whose name were you going to say?
Robin Duke.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. I'm, you know, and it's important to forgive and move on.
But there was this one scene that she totally. How much power does the host have?
Host has a lot of power. So what happens is the read-through lasts, and the way, there's all sorts of subtle things, like where your scene is in terms of the running order of the read-through has a lot to do with whether it gets on the air or not. So say you have 40 scenes, if you, as a new writer, a lot of times my scenes were, you know, and number 35 is from our new writer, Michael McCarthy, and they're just tired. They're, you know, they've kind of formulated the show anyway, and so if you can get on the first page, there's like a table of contents, then you, what happens is the producers have read everything and kind of arranged them the way they like, and then, but what happens is, so read-through goes to about 3 or 3:30, and then they go into this office with the executive producers and the director, and they come up with the running order. And the host can say, I'm not going to be in that, I would like to do this. And a lot of times I made the mistake of, I did this with Robin Williams hosted. I wrote something he loved, he championed it. It did not get into the running order, but what happened was, you know, Robin Williams loved it and liked me, and then he went away, and I...
What do you mean he went away?
Well, I mean, he was only hosted for a week.
Right.
So he left for the next week, and then the producers who I had become unaligned with remained. So in terms of my strategy of like, hey, that one host loved me. Oh, I have to work for these people now. You know, it was kind of like that, very naive to the system. I can't imagine it's much different now, even though, you know, it's just a very, a lot of bright, neurotic people competing with each other. But you asked more specific questions would be a lot of Eddie Murphy stuff. A lot of Tim Kazurinsky stuff that he did. He did a character, Jack Banowski. He did... we made up a guru named Having a Good Time Vishnu We're Here. and so we would have unanswered questions of the universe. And that was a lot of fun to, you know, get questions. We actually asked the audience to send questions in, which I had to read them, over 1,000 questions. And weirdly, from a lot of guys in prison, which is disconcerting.
But they're looking for answers, too.
Yeah.
We got
Why
one.
Can't I make my mom orgasm?
Yes, over here.
You spoke a little bit to like using your writer's brain as a crutch when you improvise. Do you feel like an improviser should have a little bit of a writing brain? Like, does one lend itself to the other and more?
Yeah, I think that it's different entrances to the same house. Yeah. And I think that it's all storytelling. Like Dell used to always say, it's all storytelling. And I agree. I think that the thing with improv is that you kind of have to embrace the disposability of it. Oh, look, it's gone. Like, even celebrate that. Like, it's breathing. It's like, and yay, it's gone, and look, everybody in the room participated. And with writer, it's, you know, it's precision. It's like getting the precise word, you know, the ellipses, exactly, and celebrating that. So, although it is storytelling, there are two separate muscles that kind of make it better, you know.
You also said something interesting. To get a job writing for TV, there's a self-promotion part of it.
Oh, yeah.
That improvisers, I think a lot of people resist. How much is talent and how much to get a writing job on TV, and how much is self-promotion?
A lot of it. I in my classes that I teach, I do, I have everybody get an art notebook and a commerce notebook, particularly writing for television, which, you know, out of the gate is commercials. So mm-hmm. there's a lot, if you're, you know, more, and I'm kind of doing this now, but if you're like, if it's very important that your words not be manipulated, manacled, changed, then playwriting, you know, become a playwright and go to, you know, Iowa State don't go to LA. But to promote yourself as a writer, you write a spec script. You sign with an agent. They use that script as a sales tool to get you meetings, and then those executive producers hire you to be a staff writer, and you matriculate up that process. But it's at every turn, there's lots of people evaluating whether you're what they want, you know, and it's a very competitive job because a lot of people want to do it, but writers, for the most part, are not salesmen. But so you have to kind of, at least I encourage, because it's a creative process, too. Like the idea of marketing yourself uses, you know, clever and brave in order to do that.
Well, I mean, and you had, as students, you had Tina Fey and you had Jon Favreau.
I did, yes.
What do you think besides their talent, what do you think it was that got them to where they are today?
Taking my class.
when did you have them, by the way?
Tina was in a... I came back from L.A. and taught a workshop that she took. Mm-hmm. And John Favreau was a host at Second City. Mm-hmm. I actually got him his first audition. And
which, interesting, he never got hired, though.
I know. Insane. You know? Insane. Yeah.
And then he got Rudy, the movie Rudy, remember?
I do.
And then Second City, okay, come, you want to be in a touring company?
I know.
Yeah, that was...
It's insane.
Yeah.
And John, but he was always very dedicated. I think the thing with... there are just people that you run into that have to be famous. They have to. Like, it's... And I've only met a handful, but they just... won't sleep and everything.
And though, and Tina and John were the same way?
I didn't, I mean, I always saw John, I didn't work with John, like, but I did get the sense of, you know, his meticulous, you know, he's very, very ambitious and also very opinionated as an improviser and as a, but like I keep thinking about, you know, I guess it never held as big a... I wasn't that intrigued with that. And the other thing, too, is I've certainly met and am friends with some famous people, and as you know, that doesn't make you happy at all.
I just...
Way.
All, Michael, all I want to do is I want to become famous to tell you, you know what, Michael? It really doesn't make me happy.
Well, I know. You know, it's sort of like... The hierarchy of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. I don't think being famous is.
I want to ask just a couple questions, and we got to wrap it up. You recently got married to Susan Messing.
I did. Yep.
And you moved back to Chicago with Susan and her daughter.
I did.
How did you make the decision and not have a resentment for leaving LA, coming to Chicago, moving with Susan and her daughter, and not feeling like I've given up on my dream?
No. Oh my God. No. It could not be. First off, I feel the luckiest man in the world because Susan is my third wife. I've been married two times before.
And actresses.
Yeah, I know.
You know, a lot of people say actresses are crazy, stay away, but not you.
No.
Right.
I would say that very much. Right. Susan is amazingly different, and I've never loved anybody more, and I've known Susan for 25 years, and we've married other people, and so
for practice. I read in the research you knew you guys were going to come together.
Right. Yeah. My wife is almost four times funnier than I am. Like I think it fluctuates.
How do you measure that?
Well, usually it's 3.8, but it can be like 4.1. Mm-hmm. And so, the thing that I cherish is in a relationship, her gutsy ability to tell the truth in any situation, and also nobody can make me laugh harder than Susan can by far. Like the next person is miles behind her.
What did you learn from the other two marriages that you're bringing into this one?
What did I learn from... These are great questions. Well, the first one was kind of like high school. I mean, I think she would say that, too.
Well, it was Jill Talley, and you guys were performing together, right?
Yes. It was very romantic, the idea of, like, touring and being on stage together and, you know, and completely unrealistic. And it fell apart when I went out to L.A., joined my then-wife Jill in L.A., this was the funniest thing, is I drove across the country to I knew something was up because she had rented on pay-per-view a movie called Single White Female. How ironic, you know, something to... And a couple of days later told me that we were getting divorced, and I was heartbroken, and... I think the biggest thing was just building my house on quicksand. Like, that's such an unstable thing. And then, you know, Brenda was kind of the same thing. The difference with Susan is that we're both older. We've both been sort of, you know, the victims of betrayal, which it was a kind of cohesive force that...
Did both wives cheat on you?
Officially, no.
Okay.
I would say, but there, you know, there is that kind of like, let me speak in generalities. Kind of more like, we've both been to the rodeo and had this thing happen, and so there. That's, I think, the great thing about this relationship, and then also the fact of coming back to Chicago could not be cooler. Like, I'm just so happy to be away from Los Angeles, being in LA was like being on military assignment. And when Susan and I started dating, and I was flying back and forth, it was like that, the end of the movie MASH, where I think the character Duke that wasn't carried over to the TV series, the end of the movie, somebody comes and just unceremoniously gives him his papers and he can go home. That was the feeling. It's like, oh, I'm done. You know, that, and that's truly the thing about Chicago is just, I'm elated to be here, like in a real city with real people, and not everybody has a screenplay, and you know, the guy parking your car isn't trying to give you his spec script and all that. And I
you know what I thought, because we just came back from LA, like in 5 days you lose yourself.
Yes.
You're like, everything's, you know, like you don't want to say anything bad about anybody. You just get into a real fear mode.
Right.
I mean, it's much different. You know?
It is. And you benefit from being congenial. And so being congenial becomes this MO for work. And then you lose yourself. You it's very subtle, but you begin to go, you know, like for instance, if you know, you have a house in Pacific Palisades, and
which is a big fancy, it's fancier than Malibu.
Right. And you figure your mortgage is like $5,200 a month,
right,
or something, and then suddenly you're on a staff, and then you're not on a staff, or you're on a show, and so you end up doing Hollywood Squares, and why am I here? You know, that you're suddenly adrift, like, because these things are temporary salves, as opposed to building a career, or even, heaven forbid, doing good work. That's never in the equation. And I think in Chicago, because it's not just TV, you know, there's all sorts of things going on. There's just the opportunity to think more clearly and be around just a wider group of people. I remember a quote that Neil Simon had was that in Los Angeles there were 70 interesting people, and he had met all of them. So that's why he was going back to New York. And I can way understand.
We got to wrap this up. I have one quick question, and if you give me a real quick answer. Someone sent us in a question to us here at Improv Nerd, and they said, is it possible with the internet to be a writer for a show without actually moving to L.A.?
I think it's becoming more a possibility. I think yes. I mean, I'm working at DePaul, and DePaul is a huge, wonderful program. It has computer and digital media program. It's gone in 8 years from 33 people to over 1,000. And a lot of it has to do with the redistribution of that business model. The idea, I mean, LA blew up because long days during Chaplin's time.
Mm-hmm.
We have, technologically, we don't need the LA days anymore to shoot movies. And also, you get very sick of the same office buildings. Like, oh, look, the same street that they went over in Bullet. Oh, Starsky and Hutch. Oh, you know, just really, walking around L.A., you have a sense of deja vu because you've seen all those locations a million times. So if nothing else, in Chicago, there's just fresh locations. So that's why.
So it is, you think in the future it is possible?
Yes, I do.
Great. Michael McCarthy, thank you so much for being our guest.
And there you have it, another episode of Improv Nerd. I want to thank our guests today, Michael McCarthy, and the good people here at Stage 773 in Chicago, our home base. And as always, my producer, Ben Caprero. I could not do this show without him. He's the one who makes it sound so good. And our sponsor, Hotel Lincoln. I feel like such a success. I feel like at the end, when Oprah would say where her guests stay, they stay at whatever. Our guests stay at the Hotel Lincoln. And if you're ever in Chicago and you want to check out a hotel that's not only reasonably priced, but they've just done a great renovation. It's super funky. It's super kitschy. And it's in the heart of Lincoln Park, which means it's a couple blocks from Second City. It's a cab ride to I.O., the Annoyance Theater, and Comedy Sports. Hotel Lincoln here in Chicago. If you need more information about me, Jimmy Corain, I like just saying me, Jimmy Corain, go to jimmycorain.com. You'll get information about Improv Nerd, my wonderful improv blog, and any of my upcoming workshops and classes. And if you want to help me with my low self-esteem, go to our Facebook page, Improv Nerd, and like us. I want to thank you for listening. I really appreciate all the great feedback you guys give us. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run. Oh yeah, Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd. Oh yeah, Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it. And here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right. Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL. The 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome, not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced Ve A Pay in Spanish,
oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my God.